So folks, last night we got to talk about depression, and now we get to talk about insecurity. Yay! Yeah. Turn to page 18 in your outline. And again, I'll just remind you, I always give you more to take home and dwell upon than what we're going to sprint through here. But I also want to address this problem largely, and your pastors thought this was one of the problems they would want me to address just in a sort of a spectrum of options I gave. Because it's one of those things we don't talk about a lot, and yet it's sort of common to our daily experience. Some of you experience it more intensely. You're sort of more insecure people. But even the less insecure among us are going to relate to today's talk, because there's something inside us that is constantly evaluating us, okay? And it's related to your conscience. Your conscience is active. But that can be calibrated wrong. It can be geared to things that are not of God, but they are rather of what's being displayed for you around you. And it can cause a lot of consternation and personal suffering. So let me give you an introductory scenario just to kind of capture this. I grew up at going to a Christian school that was small enough to not be able to afford a football program, okay? So the big fall sport in Ohio, besides football, is soccer, okay? And you guys, I know there's a lot of good soccer players. In fact, somebody here was like a major league soccer player or something like that. That's awesome. And when I was in junior high, I burned in jealousy when I looked at the soccer team because they were like the Greek gods of autumn, right? They were always tan. They had their cool blonde hair like going down like this. They had like an ethos about them and a swagger. And everybody in our community would come out and gather on those bleachers to watch what those kids did. And they'd talk about, you know, who was the best and what the plays were and what the coaching was. It was an obsession of a standard of what was in, what made life worthy. And that was tough for doughy boys like me who liked books, okay? And I remember just constantly sort of wishing I were someone other than I actually was. And one night, I kind of indulged in something that I'd never done before. And that I'd indulged in just this just fit of self-pity. And it was in front of my mom. And she was wondering what was wrong with me. And I was just like, I just don't like this about myself. And I'm just not like that. And I remember it was culminating. I wasn't getting the reaction from my mom I wanted. And I remember it culminating to me saying, I just hate myself. And the look on my mom's face, I had never seen before. My mom is a super compassionate woman. She usually, her only words out are soft and sweet. And I expected her to pat my hand and be like, oh, sweetie, stop that. No, you're amazing. I love you. But her face hardened. She was angry. And the word that came out of her mouth surprised me. She said, you have no right to hate yourself. And I kind of slunk back a little bit and had to think carefully about what she even meant. She's a sweet woman. She wasn't rejecting me, but there was a rebuke even in what she said. I had awoken some deep offense in her, and I didn't really understand why. Well, I want to tell you that I think my mom was practicing good theology there, and I'll explain why as we move through our outline together. So like we did last night, we're going to start with the common themes of this experience. What are we even talking about when we say insecurity? Then we're going to move to biblical themes that then help us understand those different themes of the experience. Okay, so let's start there. Common themes in the experience of insecurity and self-hate. Insecurity is the tendency to obsess about something you perceive as wrong with yourself. And it involves your whole heart. It involves negative, intrusive thoughts, negative feelings, and changed or altered behaviors. In other words, like all the troubles of your heart, it affects the entire way you see the world and the way you relate to it. This obsession that you have of what you ought to be kind of changes the calibration of how you think and how you act. In fact, let me give you one of my favorite examples of this. I call it my awkward pants example. You guys all have that awkward pair of pants in the back of your closet, okay? Or skirt or whatever it is, okay? It's that pair that you haven't worn in years. It's out of fashion. It doesn't fit you very well, but for some reason you just don't throw it away. And you never think about it until the laundry's piled up and for some reason you don't have fresh pants except for your awkward pants, okay? So you put on your awkward pants and you got your awkward pants on and you go to church that morning, okay? What are you thinking about? How are you feeling? What actions are altered in you as you move into the social web that you're about to move into? Maybe you can't relate to this and you're all like, now I'm the real idiot here, okay? But you put them on, you're kind of feeling insecure, but you go into work or to school, and as you're going around and you're talking to people, you're kind of wondering if they're noticing your awkward pants, okay? You're kind of noticing that you don't feel comfortable, they're not fitting right. You're wondering what others, like maybe new families visiting, they look over at you, you think of yourself as normally kind of a fashionable person, but there they are, see you in like late 90s pleated khaki pants or something like that. And you, all of a sudden, your mind, this is my point, your thoughts are orbiting around yourself. Your thoughts are not orbiting around, how can I forget myself and move towards other people in love, which is actually what God designed your interactions to be. That's the chief purpose for which he designed you. Now, that's a silly example. Let me give you maybe a more serious one. Think for a moment about the thing you most dislike about yourself, okay? The thing that you hope other people don't notice about you, okay? Think about that. For some of us, it might be thinking about the shape or the size of our body. Maybe you feel like you're too thick or you're too short or you're too tall, you're too lanky. Others of you may feel like you really struggle socially. You're more awkward than other people you observe in social situations that seem to always have a joke ready or always be able to transition the conversation to a new topic, and you don't have that. Maybe it's the fact that you're from a broken family, and you look around and you see everybody else seems like they have it all together, and their kids are successful, and they love each other, and they're not mean, but you're from a broken home. Maybe for some of you, it's about being from a lower income situation than the folks around you. And you're aware of that, and it affects the way you perceive yourself. Others, it may be your ethnicity might be different from the people that you normally interact with in your circles at work or at church or at school. There's lots of things that we could drive at, but here's my point. In terms of your thought, insecurity pulls your thinking into its orbit. It crowds out other thoughts about other things. And in terms of your feelings, it makes you feel discouraged and down, doesn't it? It doesn't make you feel thankful for who you are. It doesn't make you able to take joy in the various gifts that God gives you. It kind of makes you feel bad. And then in terms of your behaviors, doesn't it kind of make you shy away from others? Doesn't it make you disengage from them? Maybe pull into yourself a little bit? So that's what I mean when I'm talking about insecurity. And sometimes insecurity then graduates to something else, something harder. And that's our next subpoint there, to self-hate. Self-hate is your heart's attempt to condemn the person you are in preference for who you wish you were. Did you get this? You're condemning the person you are in preference for who you wish you were. That's how I would describe self-hate. So all those negative thoughts and feelings about self I just talked about, they get reinforced by decisions that you make to pull away and isolate and go into your own little place wherever you can feel safe. And then that hardens into hate. And hate means animosity. It means opposition. It means condemnation. And here's the problem with self-hate from a theological perspective. condemnation of someone or something is always based on a standard, okay? So if you're speeding down the highway and you're going 95 miles per hour, which basically never happens in Southern California, okay? Even if you could, you can't. Unless you have a Ferrari, but then when you get to 95, like, you have to hit the brakes immediately, okay? But the point is, you're cruising down. If a cop pulls you over, he's evaluating you and condemning you based on a standard that is set. He can't just arbitrarily say, I don't feel like 95 is safe, so I'm giving you a ticket. It's like, no, we have set this at 65. You were going 95, that's 30, here's your ticket. So when you hate yourself, when you indulge in those feelings of those thoughts of insecurity and self-condemnation, there's some standard that you're operating by. You may or may not be aware of it. And as we move towards what the Bible's going to tell us, you're going to find out that standard's not God's. It's yours. And now you're starting maybe to see what my mom was getting at when she reacted to me that way. You have no right to hate yourself. That's not for you. You don't set the standard. You don't get to say who you ought to be. Boy, isn't that insanely against what we hear in our culture these days? You don't get to set who you are. So this is what we mean. And the problem is these standards, right? Is who you wish you were is simply a summary. Those standards are simply a summary of your own desires. That's a good way of saying it. That standard is basically a summary of your own desires, okay? I want to be taller. I want to be faster. I want to be richer. I want to be more socially included. I want that girl. I want this. I want that. I want it all. I wish I were a little bit taller. I wish I was a baller. I wish I had a girl that looked good and I'd call her. I don't have time, but I could go into, and I genuinely won't. I can't stand it when speakers say, I could go into, and then they actually go into it, okay? But let me just make a note for you. This is actually one of the dangers of social media. By the way, I have social media. I allow my kids to have social media. I'm not sweepingly condemning it, but this is what I want you to be aware of. It sets standards in front of you constantly. And those standards shape your personal desires and your personal standards, and thus the way you measure and evaluate yourself, okay? Those are not always, it's not wrong to be influenced by the people around you, right? There's a reason that we wear certain clothes styles and not other clothes styles, and we think of them as normal. That's not wrong, but it does become wrong when it displaces God's standards, right? So let's move on to the next point there. Self-hatred is often accompanied by something else, and we could call that self-pity, which is indulging in the sorrow of your unique suffering. I suffer in a way nobody else does. This is almost inevitable when we hate ourselves, when we're constantly like playing on our insecurities. We kind of justified our minds by saying, this is uniquely my problem and nobody else can understand it. Here's how I could say it. Self-pity is a tendency to amplify your own suffering by fixating on how the reality of life doesn't match my ideals, okay? So let me say that one more time in case you are writing it down, don't feel like you need to. Self-pity is the tendency to amplify your suffering by fixating on how the reality of life doesn't match my ideal of what it should be. And so it's the difference between what it is and what it ought to be that becomes the reason I think the world is against me and me uniquely. Self-pity is our way of ignoring the blessings that God has given us in light of our preference for what he has not given us. Did you get that, guys? That's not a small problem. That's a big problem. And it dishonors the Lord. So if we're constantly calling into question, man, I'm so ugly, I'm so fat, I'm so stupid, I'm not smart like them. I don't have it together. I'm not socially engaging. This stuff that we constantly say is our theology. We're saying something about God, ultimately. We're saying, I know better than God how I ought to have been made. So I hope you're not hearing me now condemning you, simply, right? But I'm trying to put my finger on how sin kind of gets us weird. It gets us caught up in even our own self-evaluation. So with that, let's kind of look now at what does Scripture say? How do we think biblically about this trouble? Well, the first point you have there is we were made to perceive ourselves as God perceives us. Just briefly, friends, flip over to Genesis 1 or get there on your phone if you can. I want to look at a set of verses in Genesis 1 that we normally look at for other purposes. But I want to point something out that might be a game changer for you, okay? So Genesis 1, we're going to look at three verses. But let me load you up with what I want you to notice, okay? The way you see yourself is important to God. Self-perception is important to God. In fact, he directs it here in Adam. Okay? So go with me. In verse 26, what I'm about to read, we kind of get a glimpse into the intra-Trinitarian conversation. God scheming and planning who man is going to be. This is what I'm going to do in making him. We get a glimpse into that conversation. It's kind of amazing. So verse 26 says, let us make man in our own image, after our own likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the heavens and over the livestock and over all the earth and over every creeping thing that creeps on earth. So this is God thinking with him, talking in the Trinity, saying, okay, this is our chief design for human beings. We're going to set them as visible representations of who we are, of who I am, so that they can arrange and order and rule the world in a way that reflects us and shows visibly who we are, who God is. This is what God is saying. And you'll notice the language that he used. You're going to hear it again in a second, but I just want you to notice that. So then verse 27 records the actual act of him actually making them. So this was his plan, 26. Now in 27, he does it. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. So he implements. And then verse 28, this is going to be remarkable, guys. Verse 28 is the first conversation God has with this new creature called man. And I want you to notice the content of that conversation. And God blessed them and said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it and have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the heavens and over every living thing that creeps on earth. Recognize that language? It's exactly what we just saw him scheming in his plan to create man. Now, maybe that just feels, well, that's just the writer repeating things and, you know, Genesis tends to be a little bit repetitive. No. Listen, this is what's going on. Adam didn't wake up from him being created with an accurate understanding of who he was. He had to be told with words from God. Did you get that? The content of what God's plan was had to be given to Adam after his creation by words. That's super significant. Because here's the amazing thing is, the first thing God talks to Adam about is Adam. It's not God. Hey, Adam, my name's God. And I am Lord of all creation, and you will do everything I say, or I will destroy you. Okay? He wouldn't say it like that anyway. But the first topic of conversation between God and man is actually man. By the way, that doesn't mean anything weird and humanistic, like man's so important and he's the center of the universe. It doesn't mean that. It means this. It was important to God that Adam knew who he was in light of who God is. Does that make sense? I'm the one who designed you, in other words, and I'm the one who's telling you who you are. So This is really important for us, friends. We have always needed God's words to tell us how to see ourselves, even before the fall. So this is in Genesis 1. Do you know when the fall happens? We went over it the other day. It happens in Genesis 3. So it's not because we're sinful that we don't see ourselves accurately. And, well, that's involved, right? But it's not merely because we're sinful that we need God's words to see ourselves accurately. It's because he created us. And he's the one who gets to tell us who we are. So guess what, friends? This has a direct implication for you and for me. If you are not regularly listening to what God says about you in his word, then you're going to be listening to something else. You're going to be listening to someone else, or some ones. That doesn't make sense. Some many's people's. You're going to be listening to others, okay? And they are going to shape you in ways that God intended his words to shape you. Oh, this is who I am. Adam, oh, this is my design and this is my role in this newly created world. This is what I ought to be about. This is what I ought to be doing. This is the privilege of what I get to enjoy and what I get to do. That's who you listen to. God's words and God's words alone. So self-hatred means that something has gone wrong in your self-perception. And I make this my first point, guys, because all of you have a self-perception, and maybe until this moment, this talk, you were kind of only vaguely aware of that. Did you know that you see yourself in a certain way? Even knowing that is like 60% of getting there in really handling this. Because you kind of just think, this is just what naturally is true of me. But that may or may not be true of you. You have accurate thoughts about yourself, and you have inaccurate thoughts about yourself. You measure yourself by the right values in some regards, and in some regards by the wrong values. My point to you is, you can be right and you can be wrong because it's your self-perception. And so the question is, will you submit your self-perception to God's perception of you? That's the question. So that leads us to our next point here. You don't have the authority to condemn anyone, including yourself. Again, that's what my mom was getting at. That's why it was good theology that she was getting at. It's not your right to set your own standard. Did you get that, guys? I don't mean that to be harsh and condemning. I actually mean that to be freeing to you. It's not your right. You're not your creator. You are created. And God's meticulous wisdom, meticulous means down to the finest of details, how many eyelashes you have. That's kind of a gross thought, but go with me here. How many eyelashes you have is determined by not you, it's determined by your creator, and you are not as wise as he is. You are not as good as he is. You are not as generous as he is. And as we learn to adjust ourselves that way, it totally changes the way not only we see ourselves, but then the way we interact with others. You know, there's a passage in 1 Corinthians 4 that I actually want to take you to now for this point. If you wouldn't mind flipping over there. 1 Corinthians 4. This passage gives us a theme that helps us process insecurity. So I want to make it clear. I don't think Paul here is necessarily struggling with insecurity as I'm describing it here. But rather, I'm appealing to a principle that he addresses in his own self-perception, as well as the standards that he's being measured by that helps us understand our own insecurity. Okay? So I'm going to read just, you know, five verses there in a second, but let me set it up so you understand what I'm doing. So 1 and 2 Corinthians, you may be familiar with. Paul's writing to this church in Corinth, and he's just given his heart to them. He's given his life to them. He's given the gospel to them. And he's trying to love them and help them cling to the true gospel. And in that regard, or while that's going on, this group comes in that call themselves the super apostles, or Paul calls them the super apostles. They're like the studs. They're like the impressive ones. They're good looking. They're eloquent. They're successful in terms of earthly standards. And these super apostles start saying things about Paul. They start saying things like, dude, he's a loser. His eyesight's kind of crummy. He's not eloquent when he gets up and talks to you. He's all bold in his letters when he writes to you and all authoritative, but then when he's actually in front of you, he's like kind of a wuss. And besides all that, look at how much he suffers. You really want to follow a guy that's like getting beat and getting shipwrecked, never seems to find his way to the right city at the right time? You really want to follow a guy like that? No. You want to follow a Christianity of winners. You don't want to follow a Christianity of losers, okay? Paul was aware of what was being said about him to undermine his ministry. And Paul could have, if he was thinking in a fleshly way, Paul could have adopted those standards he was being measured by, become really insecure and really defensive. But I want you to notice how he actually processes it here in 1 Corinthians 4, verses 1 through 5. This is how one should regard us, as servants of Christ and stewards of the mysteries of God. Moreover, it's required of stewards that they be found faithful. But with me, it's a very small thing that I should be judged by you, or really by any human court. In fact, I do not even judge myself, for I am not aware of anything against myself, but I'm not thereby acquitted. It is the Lord who judges me. Therefore, do not pronounce judgment before the time, before the Lord comes, who will bring to light the things now hidden in darkness and will disclose the purposes of the heart. And then each one will receive his commendation from God. Friends, did you notice what Paul did there? Not in a sort of American way of saying, I don't care what you think about me. I only have to think about myself in certain ways, and your opinion doesn't matter. That's not what he's saying in the words that I just read. In the words that I just read, this is what he's saying. Hey, listen. I know you're condemning me based on what these super apostles are saying. But honestly, I'm not bothered by it, and I'm not going to change my approach to you because of it. In fact, I don't even judge myself. Now, I'm not aware of anything morally against myself, but even that, I'm not acquitted by it because I'm not the one who acquits. I have to give myself over to God as the one who judges, as the one who makes the right judgments of those standards for me. Friends, that is humility. That is humility. And Paul shows that humility by rejecting these external earthly preferences and standards that are being foisted upon him. By the way, men in here, one thing that I love about this is particularly the leaders of this church. I'm really thankful that as I hear the leaders of this church talk, they could really get caught up in sort of bigger box evangelicalism, all the awesome things that are going on, and this is what a really successful church looks like, and da-da-da-da. But you know what I hear from your pastors, friends? You should be encouraged by this. What I hear from your pastors is they're fixated on forming disciples. That's what they're fixated on. They're fixated on loving you all, not being impressive. That's a gift. Be that way yourself, men. Be that way yourself, ladies. And you will have the kind of community that reflects not a culture that stirs up insecurity in each other, but stirs up a confidence in God in each other. That's beautiful. So who you, just like the super apostles with their standards on Paul, like I said, who you wish you were is being informed by someone. It's being informed by something. Okay? That's the next point that I have there. The super apostles were way more impressive than Paul by every earthly measurement. They looked better. They spoke better. They succeeded better. Why was Paul such a loser? But just like my example of those sunlit Greek gods of junior high, the super apostles had qualities that could have captured Paul's heart and really made him go in the wrong way. And so similarly, who you wish you were is being informed by athletic prowess, physical beauty, leadership ability, natural intelligence, a knack for business that's prized in your circles. Whatever your social circles prize becomes influential over what you're measuring yourself by. The problem with self-hatred is God does not value these things in the same way. He doesn't. He doesn't measure you on the scale that you're measuring yourself. So let me just give you some examples to make it really explicit for you. Hating yourself because you're not good at sports, for instance, means that you're insisting that athleticism is essential to a person's value. God does not agree with you. Hating yourself because you're not physically attractive, by the way, in your own estimation, means that you're insisting that outward beauty is essential to a person's value, or at least that standard or style of outward beauty that your culture prizes. And guess what? Do you think God agrees with you on that? No, he does not agree with you. Or hating yourself because you're not more important in your workplace means that you're insisting some measure of career success is essential to a person's value. And God does not agree with you. So friends, when God disagrees with you, who's right and who's wrong? You ain't right. God is. And so it becomes an act of submission when we lay our self-hate out before him and we say, Lord, I have no right. I have no right. You made me. You arranged everything about me. Even the things that I wish I could change right now, you arranged it about me, and you are good, and you are wise, and you are more generous than I could ever even be with myself. So help me trust you. That's what the nearness of God means for such insecurity and self-hate. And so I'll kind of land this main point. And again, I just introduced that third point, so don't be intimidated. But I'll land this with the reminder here that insecurity is not just sin, it's also suffering, okay? So all that I've been saying to you, it is something you need to deal with in your heart before the Lord. You need to take before the Lord and submit to him. And insofar as you refuse to do that, there's sin involved in that, and you need to repent of that, okay? But I'm trying to acknowledge with this point too, that insecurity is also suffering because, remember we talked about the estrangement being you are estranged from the world and others, but it's also true that they're estranged from you. And so their inability to love as God designed them to love does cause pain to you. And so there are times when you are measured by standards that are unfair. And you and every conversation you have with your family implies that you ought to be married by now. Or it implies that you ought to perform better than you do, or it implies that your sister is way more put together than you are. It implies all those things that are these ways that we just make that standard clear to others on how they're not measuring up. You suffer under that. So I want to at least acknowledge that with you. So God isn't just looking for you to repent, though he absolutely is. He's also looking for you to just lay everything down and let him comfort you. Just to take refuge from those things. To acknowledge that does hurt. I groan with you on those things. You shouldn't be constantly measured by those things. And folks, for maybe for the majority of us, this is just sort of the garden variety social pressures that we put on each other. And that's genuine suffering. Take that to the Lord. But for some of us, it might be actually a more hardened form of that. I've talked to a lot of people that come from more extreme situations where they were condemned, where they were harmed. Maybe they were abused. Maybe they had a father that was just always angry and condemning, never said words of encouragement and love and inclusion like a dad was designed to do. Or a mom, or social circles, or a husband, or a wife who's just always pointing out what's wrong and never encouraging with what's right. Those are very hard situations, friends. I just want to acknowledge that God knows that pain, and he's with you in that pain. And as you trust him, he will help you resist the urge to take in those standards in yourself and in your own self-perception. He will help you. And so that living by faith when experiencing self-hate, that's really just a strategy, friends, that you can kind of read through for yourself. I kind of walk you through things like identifying and expressing and submitting your desires for yourself to the Lord. You don't want to ultimately give an accusation against God that he didn't do something right when he made you. But then landing, friends, in the glorious fact that in Christ, even when you feel like your insecurity is winning, it doesn't. He loves you. He knows you. And even when you screw up and you find yourself in that same cycle of self-talk that's condemning, he's standing there in the background saying, I don't condemn you. I don't condemn you. I don't condemn you. Listen to my voice. Don't listen to your voice. Listen to my voice. I'm the shepherd who loves you. You're the sheep who doesn't even know what to think about yourself. Listen to me. I know where I'm going. I know who you are. I know what's best for you. He's going to respond compassionately. So let me pray. Father, thank you again for the privilege of gathering under your word and considering, Lord, even something like insecurity and self-hate. It's just not a great topic to talk about. And yet, Father, I do think we are often captured by the evil one here. So I pray that even this morning you'd start to free your people from the influence of the world, from the influence of the evil one, and how they see themselves, Lord. And Father, would you reassure them that your love for them is far stronger than even their hate for themselves. In Jesus' name, amen.